Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Khadir Shafi is a Palestinian activist and strategist born and based in Palestine, Israel. She's a co-founder of Azwat, Palestinian Feminist Queer Center for Sexual and Gender Freedoms, and has spent the last decade of her life passionately advocating for the intersectionality of the struggle of Palestinian queer women, fighting multiple forms of oppression as Palestinians in the context of Israel's system of apartheid, military occupation, and settler colonialism. As women in a militaristic and imperialistic male-dominated society, and as queers in the context of pinkwashing and homophobia. In doing so, she contributed to gathering more committed and engaged global feminists and queers to rally around Palestine. Her interviews and articles appear in various media outlets and academic papers, Arab and international. So welcome, Khadir. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And I want to also extend my condolences. It sounds silly to say, but for what my government is facilitating, it's shameful and outrageous. And so I'm sending you love and support and solidarity. It's heartbreaking from over here. So I can't imagine what it's like to be living what you all are living.
Thank you very much, Katie, for saying that. Of course. Thank you very much.
So let's just start off by talking about the intersectionality of this struggle, what that means to you as an individual and what that means for the communities that you're a part of.
Well, when we talk about intersectionality of struggles, it means we try to see the intersection of oppression as Palestinian, as women, as queer. And in the case of Israel, as Palestinians, we live under settler colonialism, apartheid, and occupation, whether living inside Israel or in the occupied Palestinian territories or in besieged Gaza Strip. As women in a very militaristic, sexist society that usually oppress women's rights and freedoms, and as queers in the context of homophobia and pinkwashing, it's important for us to fight to achieve the full menu of rights. And I know a lot of queer people around the world, they want to save Palestinian queers, but my answer is thank you, but no thank you. We don't need saving as queers. We have managed to raise the bar within our own community, with our national movement, within the feminist movement. And mostly we need savings as Palestinians, because right now Israel is killing Palestinians for being Palestinians.
And what do you have to say to the people who respond to what Israel is doing and what the United States is supporting, and say things like, oh, well, Hamas wants to throw gay people off of the roofs, and it's nice for, you know, queers for Palestine. That's funny. That's so laughable because they would kill you. What's your response to those types of talking points?
I think, first of all, it's horrible to call for the killing and murder of innocent human beings, regardless of their sexual and gender identity. The scenes from Gaza are beyond description. They defy comparison, even for Palestinians who have been suffering for decades from occupation, apartheid, and settler colonialism. You see devastated landscape filled with piles of ruins of what once used to be people's homes and people's lives. See dead bodies or part of them, pieces of them. You see orphaned children screaming in terror and fear. Israel is starving Palestinians in Gaza. You see kids looking for food in the rubble. You see parents begging for food to feed their children. So in these horrific, horrific scenes, one scene really stands out is, it shows, you know, as a queer person, watching these images of horror, devastation, starvation, of my own people, feeling so much despair and feeling completely helpless. One image stood out as particularly revolting in a rather different way. It shows an Israeli soldier in the middle of the rubble, of one of the many residential neighborhoods in Gaza that Israel flattened by its nonstop military airstrikes. In the distance, smoke from Israel's carpet bombings hang in the air, and the soldier is surrounded by many Israeli tanks that demolish everything in their way. It's a scene of death and destruction, and the soldier stands holding a bright new rainbow flag with the words, "In the name of love," claiming that he's sending a message of hope. And my question is, what hope is there for over 2.3 million Palestinians trapped for over 17 years in the occupied and besieged Gaza Strip? In the words of the UN General Secretary Antonio Guterres, Gaza has become a graveyard for children. Is this what people are advocating for, to kill innocent children? These people in Gaza, they have no water, no food, no electricity. For over 147 days, they have been bombarded nonstop. Wherever they go, if they seek shelter at a UN school, they get bombarded. In hospitals, there are no safe passages for Palestinians in Gaza. I think that this stunt, which was shared online by Israeli state officials and social media accounts, is a textbook example of, the obscene colonial pinkwashing. It's more than that. It's even pinkwashing on steroids. To see these scenes and to try to pinkwash genocide, we have seen Israel using pinkwashing for so many years in order to pinkwash its crimes against the Palestinians. And we heard many experts say that what Israel is doing right now is a textbook case of genocide. And with this soldier is doing, I think there were many others like him who followed his lead. This is a textbook case of pinkwashing, and we should be aware of that. And I think it's shameful that people are actually advocating for LGBT rights by Israel when Israel is actually killing queer people. We didn't hear about queer people being killed in Gaza before, but now we see queer people lying in graves, in mass graves, all killed by Israel, with no exception. So I think these facts speak for themselves. And I think people who choose to be blind, who choose to be inhuman, that's the only word I can think of. It's inhuman to think that Palestinians in Gaza deserve to die like this, with no support whatsoever. The whole world, that the government abandoned Palestinians in Gaza. I know that I still have hope because I see how grassroots movements are organizing. I see how people around the world, nations, people of all ages, people who didn't really care about Palestine and Gaza before, are standing with everything they have. They're risking their lives, their jobs, their friendships also, in order to stand with justice in Palestine. So I really don't have any words to convince people to be human. I think that this war has made things clear, and I think it has exposed. It has exposed the government. It has exposed a lot of the international institutions, that the U.S., which is complicit in this genocide and is actually sending bombs to Israel to allow it to kill more Palestinians, more Palestinian women, more Palestinian children, more Palestinian queers, and the other countries which are complicit with Israel are also complicit with this genocide. And it's very clear to all of us. And I think it's important for us not to trust these governments anymore. I think each and every one of us, as individuals, as citizens, as human beings, we have the power to change. And I know there are a lot of atrocities around the world. There are also genocides elsewhere in the world. But I think in the case of Palestine and Gaza, each and every one of us can be effective. Each and every one of us, from her own and his own position and their own position, can be effective and can call for an immediate ceasefire right now and for a permanent ceasefire for Gaza, for relief to all the people. It's really, it's shameful, the aid that Gazans are receiving. It's like, really, I watch the videos and I don't know what to think. that even the countries who are trying to send aid, they're not really sending the necessary aid. So I don't know what is left to say. I don't know what is left for Gazans to say. They have been in war for 147 days. They are filming the war. We are watching the genocide live, each and every one of us. You don't have to watch CNN on Fox News. Go to your Instagram, go to your TikTok, you know, on social media platforms. Follow people who live in Gaza. Follow journalists, those who haven't been killed by Israel or targeted by Israel. Follow, you know, random people in Gaza. You will see the death. You will see the destruction. It did not spare anyone. It did not spare the people, the children, the houses, the hospitals, the mosques, the churches, the animals. It didn't spare anything. And if we stand and keep silent and claim that people, innocent people, deserve to die, then I don't know what kind of a world we live in.
Thank you so much for sharing. And we're going to keep the conversation going. We're going to bring on Dean Spade. I'm really excited to have both of you in conversation. Dean Spade is a professor at the Seattle University School of Law. Dean has been working to build queer and trans liberation based in racial and economic justice for the past two decades. He is the author of Normal Life, Administrative Violence, Critical Trans Politics, and the Limits of Law, and the director of the documentary Pinkwashing Exposed, Seattle Fights Back. His latest book is Mutual Aid, Building Solidarity During This Crisis and the Next. So welcome, Dean. Hi, Dean.
Hi, nice to see both of you.
You too. Thank you so much for joining, Dean.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be on your show again.
So we are talking about the violence on so many levels being inflicted on Palestinians and, of course, the pinkwashing. And I wanted to ask you, Dean, if you could share with us what got you interested in pinkwashing, and also maybe if you could explain for people who don't know what pinkwashing is.
Yeah. In, you know, all my adult life, I've been part of movements in the U.S. focused on prisons and policing, queer and trans liberation, like you said in my intro. And in that context, we see a very similar thing. So I was already, you know, very familiar with this dynamic as it operates, like, you know, most obviously you can see it like in the Obama administration, but you can see it going back where you have like corporations or politicians who are doing things that are bad for people. And then they're like, but I'm gay friendly. And that has happened in, you know, lots of different fronts for a long time. And I came up in New York City politically, like that's where I got active. And in New York City, there's a lot of like solidarity with Puerto Rico, solidarity with Palestine. So that was integrated into my politics. But it was really in the maybe early 2010s when more Palestinian queer activists started talking about the pinkwashing they were seeing the Israeli government doing. And what that looked like, what they were saying, and that what I was learning from was that there was a big Israeli effort to rebrand the country's public image, which people call Brand Israel, which was something that was developed by PR people in the U.S. and Israel, aimed at making Israel look like an innovative, green, diverse, social justice-y country, trying to change its global brand as like a brutal occupier, you know, settler colonial project. And so that included like a lot of like force around trying to spin that image. And one part of that is an image of gay, of Israel as a gay friendly country. So that included like a lot of stuff around, look, gay people can serve in the military. It also included work to promote gay tourism in Israel and just to believe as a gay capital. There's sort of this branding method that is really aimed at an international audience. And in my opinion, it's not actually aimed primarily at a gay audience. It's aimed at straight people associate gay politics, which is associated with liberation and with freedom, with this place, right? So its aim is to cover over the reality of the politics of this place, which is the exact reversal of anything liberatory or about freedom or people's well-being. And one part of this is that the Israeli consulate pays for like Israeli gay and lesbian activists and films made about gay people in Israel to tour the U.S. and Canada and other places where you know, the sort of the audience of this pinkwashing project. And so I became involved with people in the U.S. and Canada who are trying to expose what that was when that kind of propaganda comes to our towns. And I also became more closely connected to queer and trans activists in Palestine who were trying to really collaborate with people all over the world to push back on this pinkwashing image. So that's in the, I'd say the early 2010s, more of that became part of our conversation in a global conversation amongst queer and trans activists who oppose wars and racism and sort of all the things pinkwashing is trying to cover up.
Dean, were you ever seduced by this, whether pinkwashing or, I don't know, rainbow washing or the kind of, you know, pantsuit feminism, rainbow pantsuit feminism? Did that ever work on you, or were you always critical of these charades?
The place where I had to learn this personally was in the mid 90s when I was, young queer, and the issue of the day was the like Hawaii same-sex marriage case and then some of the other early same-sex marriage advocacy. And I was very confused. I was like, well, I guess same-sex marriage must be really important because maybe that means that it will make us stop being criminalized. Because right at the time, sodomy laws still exist and it was a crime to have sex with queer and trans people in the US. And so I was like, maybe this is really important and will free us and everyone will see that we're quote unquote normal. I totally bought into that. And I, at the same time, was working in queer nightlife and I was, meeting a lot of radical queer people, many of whom had previously been in ACT UP. And those people were anti-marriage and they were telling me why. And they were explaining to me that this was actually an agenda alongside getting gay people into the military, which was also really popular right then, to kind of make a new gay politics that, that restored what had been, what are like these US institutions that have been, under attack by our movements for generations, right? Like for generations, feminists have been trying to get rid of marriage because it's a terrible way to distribute well-being and it forces people to organize their lives according to the state's like sort of favorite family formation and sexuality norms in order to get like healthcare and immigration status. And so the idea of having gay people be like wanting to join it and making it like a site of equality and liberation was actually restoring like a really evil, terrible institution. And same with the military. The US military is the largest polluter in the world, a totally illegitimate institution that is the largest purveyor of violence on the planet. And the idea that making gay people be in there somehow, makes it a place of justice and freedom pro-military propaganda that we are against. And so for me, that was a key moment and I think that stuff now, I mean, that analysis now is even more obvious and important, right? Like I was just, reading about how regularly the Israeli government will post pictures of proposals between same-sex couples who are in the IDF in their uniforms. So it's propaganda for the Israeli military that's just to make you take your feelings of one, romance, and two, like gay people as a symbol of like rebellious, wonderful, like freedom, and apply that to a military, So like that bait and switch is so complex, and that bait and switch really happened here in the US. Like that was successful. Like we have like solidly the Democratic Party uses pinkwashing to cover over all of its imperialism and racism. And so for me, that those early moments where I think pinkwashing wasn't really happening as profoundly yet in US politics, but it was on the horizon, were when I was sort of seduced by it and just kind of by sheer luck because of the work I was doing, met queers who were really hip to it and were like, actually, that has nothing to do with us and it's not going to be good for us and it's not going to solve our problems. And we live now in a US in which gay marriage is legal, gay people are in the military, trans people are in the military. And queer people are incarcerated more than they've ever been incarcerated. Our rents are higher than they've ever been. More of us are unhoused. More of us are in immigration detention because that's the conditions we live under. None of those things don't undermine that pathway to misery for our people. So I think it's, I think it is really seductive. And there's nothing wrong with any of us being like, oh, wow, for a minute that got me. The question is, can we help each other spot propaganda and not be pulled into it and not be, and not have it like impede our ability to do what we all know needs to be done in terms of like caring about life on earth and refusing these wars.
And Khadir, what is the effect of pinkwashing for kind of on the ground for the people of Palestine?
Well, like Dean said, pinkwashing is a colonial tool that aims to oppress all Palestinians and promote itself as liberal and modern. And portray Palestinians as backwards and homophobic, and unworthy of human rights. So I think that what also distinguishes, pinkwashing from like whitewashing and artwashing and purple washing, that it also, aims to, portray all Palestinians as backwards and homophobic. And like you said, look at, how Palestinians are being killed. and therefore we are not worthy of these rights. And so it's an international agenda, but it's also an internal agenda to also keep us at a disadvantage. For example, when Aswa tried to advocate for sexual and diversity, sexual and gender diversity within schools, Israeli schools were allowed to do so, but they did not allow anyone to do it within Arab-Palestinian schools that operate within Israel. In order to say that we're not ready for these contents and we will continue. So when I went to school, there was no talk of sexual identity and sexual and gender identity. Maybe 30 years later, when my son went to school, there was still no talk about that. So we also learned that pinkwashing is an internal agenda to continue to keep Palestinians, you know, in the dark about our sexual and gender identity. And I would also add, you know, pinkwashing can appear in many, many, many forms. If you look at the queer cinema in Israel, always portraying, you know, the queer Palestinians as backwards with a homophobic family and, you know, enlightened, modern, liberal Israeli is teaching the backward Palestinian how to eat with chopsticks and how to, you know, go out into the world and be civilized. So we've seen many similar productions of that. And therefore it was important to create a queer cinema for Palestine, a platform that actually encourages artists, producers, filmmakers to boycott the Tel Aviv Film Festival until Israel complies with international law and human rights, and to offer an alternative platform for artists and filmmakers to be in solidarity with Palestine and present their queer art in resistance to all forms of oppression, including occupation, settler colonialism, and occupation. But if you go to the personal stories of many, many Palestinian queers, when I was a teenager questioning my sexuality, of course, as I said earlier, there was no talk in school about sexual and gender identity. And I actually, went to live in Tel Aviv, being young and naive, thinking that I would, you know, explore my sexuality there, when in fact, very soon I realized that I can't be Palestinian and queer in Tel Aviv. All of my Israeli friends asked me to change my name to an Israeli name so I would, you know, become an Israeli gay or queer woman. To me, it seemed really ridiculous and abysmal and appalling, because I've been a Palestinian all my life and I just started to question my sexuality. So for me, being Palestinian was more important. And I just packed my stuff and left Tel Aviv without looking back. And it was only 10 years later when I came to Aswa that I was able to reconcile my national identity with my sexual identity and gender identity. So I think I've heard similar, many, many similar stories from Palestinians who, you know, face the same discrimination, and it's like the Israelis trying to constantly enforce their rhetoric of what it means to be gay or queer. And of course, you see a lot of promotions within the Israeli army. You can be queer in the Israeli army, and so on and so forth. In order to show that, you know, it's an open army and it's a moral army. But we also see the genocide committed against innocent Palestinians, queer and non-queer alike. We have seen 75 years of occupation, apartheid, and settler colonialism. We have seen over 17 years of siege. And we see now what's happening, not just in Gaza, which is the worst thing ever, the genocide, the ongoing genocide. Look at the West Bank. People are being also arrested. People are being attacked. Cities are being invaded. Look at what's happening to Palestinians inside Israel. There's no expression of anything. You can't demonstrate. You can't share a post. You can't. You know, everything is monitored, everything. If I leave the house, I see more guns than people. If I go to university, you see more guns than laptops. I take the train to Jerusalem and there are soldiers and civilians and women with a yoga mattress, but with a rifle on her shoulder. So this is a scene of war. Israel is taking the war everywhere. They go to the beach with their guns. They go to university. They go to yoga classes. They go to meditation with their guns. So this is the society we live in. It's fear and horror and chaos. And I want to tell you even more. What's happening right now in Israel, this is one of the scenes. I was taking the train to Jerusalem. The first thing I saw when I left the train station in Jerusalem was a man standing on a big stand with a lot of people around him holding a sign. With one bullet, you kill a Palestinian. He had huge signs and stickers. So I approached him to see him speaking with a few young men, also with guns and rifles, and saying, this is what we need to do. This is the Israeli plan. First you kill, then you occupy, then you colonize. And all of them were nodding, yeah, colonization is important. 2 minutes later, I heard two men walking next to me saying, okay, let's go find a Palestinian to kill. I put my phone on silent in case my mom doesn't call me and they hear me speak Arabic. And I asked for instructions in English. This is the scene right now. People can't go out sometimes because they are looking for Palestinians to kill.
So sorry that you have to deal with that.
That we're funding it. That's being, I mean, it's so overwhelming, you know, to be in the U.S. and feel how utterly non-responsive. It doesn't matter how unpopular this genocide becomes. If we needed any further evidence, which I think we've known for a long time that our government has nothing, the war machine has nothing to do with consent of the population of the U.S. or anywhere else, and that it rages on. And, you know, I think about the early moments of the war in Iraq and the largest demonstrations that had ever occurred on earth, and it just barreled forward. And that, I think, is just a very profound lesson that I hope people in the U.S. are getting from this, that we do not live in it's a farce, the idea that there's any kind of consent required for whatever the war machine wants to do to whoever it wants to do it to on earth, even though everyone in the world knows this is a completely outrageous genocide. Like, it's so intense that our powerlessness, if we think our only option is to try to convince the war machine through moral persuasion, because it is not happening.
So what can we do? I mean, I'll ask both of you. Adir, what can we do from over here? And Dean, what can we do given that our government is not responsible? How do we make a difference? As corny as that question sounds, and I'm sorry if it sounds like such a basic one, but yeah, how do we proceed?
As I said earlier, there's so much the free citizens of the world, and especially people in the U.S., can do in order to stop this genocide right now and ask for an immediate and permanent ceasefire on Gaza, to ask for humanitarian aid, real humanitarian aid, sufficient humanitarian aid to enter into Gaza, and to ask for UN protection for Palestinians in Gaza. These are the most urgent demands right now. How to organize? I think you know how to organize best within your own context, but we need to really organize fast in mass demonstrations and put more pressure on the people who make decisions, because it's been 147 days of death and destruction. People are dying every minute. People are suffering every minute. It is our human duty to do everything we can in order to stop this ongoing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. And to stop, I can't even begin to imagine what will happen next with the ethnic cleansing and the transfer of people. And I have no words for the devastation that we are feeling right here. You don't have to be in Gaza in order to feel what Gazans are going through. You only have to be human.
I know that you've been collecting testimonials. Is there anything that you want to share with us about what you've learned from people in Gaza?
Well, I heard and read many testimonies from people on the ground, from journalists, from people who were... And I think what really, really struck me most was testimonies about starvation. Children not eating for days, parents going out to try and bring some food from the so-called aid trucks, only to find their deaths. Some of them don't come back because Israel's targeting them while they are waiting for the aid trucks. Some people wait for 7 hours or 10 hours for the A-truck in the streets. And once the A-truck begins to near the location of the people, Israeli tanks appear and they start shooting people. Israeli quadcopters, they shoot people. They kill people. 30 to 50 to 70 people die every time people go to look for food. Some of them don't come back. Some of them just run home without anything, you know, being grateful that they saved their lives. So I think the footage of starvation, the whole world sent to Africa when it was starving, when we saw the children of Africa starving. We've seen many, many scenes of other people starving, but what's happening right now in Gaza is a deliberate starvation effort by Israel, the mass killing, the torture, no safe passages for people. Even when people try to move from one place to another, as Israel demands, snipers keep targeting them and shooting at them all the time. So people have nowhere to go. There's no access. Everything is closed. We need to give them, first of all, hope. We need to give them a space to breathe. We need to give them some kind of assurance that we didn't abandon them, that the world still believes that all people have the right to live with dignity. All people have the right to live with freedom, regardless of their background, their skin color, their religion, their nationality, their race, their sexual orientation, regardless of anything. And this is the message that Gazans, they don't get, they don't see it. They see that they are left alone for 17 years and now for 147 days being slaughtered, dead, beaten, starved, tortured. I've read testimonies of people who were kidnapped as hostages by Israel from their homes, mothers and fathers and young men. They were tortured for many days, for no reason whatsoever. Innocent civilians had nothing to do with anything. So these are the stories that we hear, and we feel so helpless because we still live in apartheid Israel. There's very little we can do. So I call on every person who considers himself, herself, themselves as a human being, as someone who cares about humanity, not just Palestine. We should make sure that everyone has the ability to live with dignity. I think people should do much more. We've done so much until today, and it didn't stop the genocide. We have to do much more. And I hope that Dean has more ideas for us to be more effective.
Yeah, I think that it's such a hard moment to really face how impermeable to see how much mobilization there has been by people in the U.S. trying to stop the unrelenting aid to Israel to engage in this genocide, and to see how much mass action, how much expression of horror and, you know, not in our name and all of this, and how that it goes on. And I think, you know, for me, it really raises these questions. Of course, I think we should always continue that, of course, partly because that's how we meet each other in the streets and that's how we build camaraderie and meet people to do other kinds of actions with. But I'm also interested in some of the more targeted work people are doing to target arms manufacturers. I'm part of a group called Dissenters, which has chapters on college campuses all over the U.S. Focused on stopping war and really targeting the ways that universities and other institutions are tied in with weapons and manufacturers. I've been a big supporter and connected and mentoring people in chapters and the National Group of Students for Justice in Palestine. Everyone can support the work of those student organizers who are at the cutting edge of this work and who are constantly punished on their campuses, who are censored on their campuses, who have their chapters of their organizations, banned on the campus. I'm really interested in the work of PAL Action in the UK and PAL Action here in the United States, both of which are, again, targeting Elbit, targeting these other major corporations that make the operations of the Israeli government throughout Palestine possible, and that, you know, do weapons and do walls. And people are doing very targeted, you know, sabotage actions, shutdown actions, much more direct, not just like, hey, please stop, but also like, now we're stopping you. And I am curious, when I look around at the global history of people trying to stop war machines like this, and other like sort of, you know, outrageous functions of things as large and hard to transform as states and corporations. I'm interested in the ways we could see those tactics escalate in the US. Like, it's like one thing to shut down a company for 8 hours. What's it like to shut them down for 8 months or 8 years? What does it look like if more people are involved in these fights and if the tactics are bold and we say it cannot go on, it will not go on? I also want to name one other campaign I've heard about that I'm really excited about, which is people working to stop Israel bonds. Israel bonds are a way that both individual people in all over the world and also sometimes like state treasuries will buy in. They're basically giving money directly to the Israeli treasury, which we know that will go to fund the genocide. And then you take like a, it's basically like you're giving a loan. And so like states, like the state of Pennsylvania just did like a multi-million-dollar Israel bond. Like this is happening not so, and also it's something people sometimes give each other like for a wedding gift or whatever. So there's a campaign to really look at that. So if you live in a state where recently Israel bonds were bought by your state treasurer, like that's a great political target, that state treasurer, that whole process, you know, a demand to, you know, sell and get rid of all Israel bonds and to not have our, or maybe your union did, or maybe you're in a university. So to stop this pretty enormous, like, you know, funding of, the Israeli government and its military by like our local institutions. There's a lot of organizing opportunities there. I recently saw Dissenters had a really wonderful slide deck on Instagram, that shows kind of what are some of the big players who've recently bought Israel bonds. And you can just do this research in your own, at your university, at your union, at whatever institutions you're part of. Like, have they bought Israel bonds? Can we build a campaign to pressure them to stop? And that has multiple benefits. It both is materially stopping funding to Israel to do the genocide, and it's helping whatever you're involved in, your local groups, your local institutions, be a place where people are learning a lot more deeply what the project of colonialism in Israel is and why it matters to everyone on earth and certainly to everyone in the US, its biggest funder and supporter. And so I think there's no end to what we can do. I think it's wonderful that a lot of people have like gone to protests. And I wonder if we can all turn up even beyond that. We're going to protest and we're also joining sustained work at our university, in our union, against our city government's, you know, engagement with Israel bonds or sending our city cops to Israel to trade. All the gross ties. I mean, we were talking earlier about like film festivals and Tel Aviv Pride. You know, at one point, the mayor of Seattle went to Tel Aviv Pride. We protested that. You know, there's so many ties. I think that one of the lies of living in the US is that everywhere else in the world is some faraway place that you don't need to worry about and it's too complicated for you to think about. And in reality, we are like, we are all right involved and tied into with each other. And if there is brutality and violence and genocide happening in Palestine, I am part of it at my university, in my union, in my city government. And so how do we find every single one of those ties and apply maximum pressure through direct action? Not just asking those people to change, but forcing them to stop supporting what we know like must stop.
And going back a little bit to, you shared a little bit about your personal journey, and I'm curious for both of you, I have questions about that. So Hadir, you said that you felt like you needed to go to Tel Aviv, right? And then you discovered, or I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you went to Tel Aviv when you were starting to question your sexuality. It seems like you had an aha moment, right? When people were encouraging you to change your name. So what happened next? Like, what was the next step for you in terms of your personal journey, but also your politicization?
Yeah, well, basically, just to clarify, at the time, I called the White Line, which was operated by an Israeli organization. And the guy on there, you know, I just, like, said, I'm questioning my sexuality. I'm not sure. And he said, oh, you're a lesbian. You should move to Tel Aviv. So also, you know, giving me the identity, naming me and just like sending me to a place where I can, you know, it's like part of the whole pinkwashing, even though pinkwashing was not coined at the time.
But it was happening.
Yeah. So basically, I believe that it's problematic, you know, to be both queer and Palestinian. And at the time, it didn't really dissolve into anything, but it certainly did allow me to have a very clear perspective on Israeli society. And, you know, the celebration of democracy, that we're not part of this democracy. We live in an apartheid state where our rights and freedoms are, dependent on, the colonizers And it was important for me to also be involved in initiatives within my own community. And perhaps it took, you know, a few years for me to become part of ASWAT, but also to, you know, to have to have this intersection of identity. We spoke about intersectional discourses and what it means to, you know, fight for your rights, you know, as a Palestinian, as queer, and as a woman. I think it really defined these identities in a way that just the message for me was to work within my own communities, you know, to be part of grassroots initiatives that would allow more people to join in and be part of, be part of our community at the time. And of course, it just like, it gave me all the incentive and the passion and the more reason to establish a space that allows Palestinian queer women and trans women and queer people to be part of. And of course, create all these services, like have a support line for Palestinians to call when they question their identity or they have any questions for them, their friends, their parents, to also have educational workshops to not just talk about it within our own queer circles, but also to raise awareness amongst, especially for in schools. For me, it was really important since Israel's pinkwashing agenda tried to constantly keep us away from, you know, educating youngsters in schools. So, and of course, to have a queer film festival in order to counter the narrative of the Israeli that tried to portray us and to allow us to tell our own stories and the different diverse stories of Palestinian queers, whether, you know, you're based to defy also the, you know, geographic fragmentation and the political fragmentation that Israel has imposed on us for the past 75 years. So I think, you know, out of this experience, many things grew in terms of what needs to happen in order for us to be able to live here with dignity as queers, as Palestinians, as women, as trans. Yeah.
Can either of you talk about the way Israel will weaponize people's sexual identity and weaponize homophobia to blackmail people? I know that's something that Israel, while claiming to be this champion of LGBTQ rights, will often do.
Do you want to talk more about that? I feel like my knowledge of that is not as deep as probably yours is.
Well, basically, one of the things that Israel has been doing for many years is to target gay people, whether, you know, in the West Bank or besiege Gaza, and to try and paint them as collaborators. So they would be targeted by their own communities. And Israel has, you know, done that many, many times, creating all these false tales about, you know, we save Palestinian queers and we allow them to come and live in, you know, gay haven Tel Aviv, as if there's a pink door at apartheid wall that says, if you're queer, then, you know, you're more than welcome to come and enjoy our gay haven. And if you're not, then we'll continue to oppress you. So Israel has been, you know, very ridiculous in, you know, telling these stories, how they save Palestinian queers, again, through, you know, their narrative, their productions, their cinema, their films and movies. But I think more than anything, Israel is weaponizing, you know, it's pinkwashing. Israel is currently weaponizing anything and everything. And we have to be very, very specific, because sometimes when we talk about pinkwashing in the global sense, we can't even begin to understand or, you know, imagine what Israel is doing, you know, in the name of LGBT rights. Here, even LGBT organizations within Israeli society were complaining that they're not getting, you know, any of the money that Israel is saying that. So it's just an international strategy to divert the, you know, the attention from the gross violation of human rights and international law, and continue to portray Israel as liberal. And unfortunately, some Israeli gay organizations also cooperate with this rhetoric. You see a lot of the soldiers in the army are also trying to reinforce this rhetoric. And I think it's ridiculous that people around the world, or some people around the world, are actually using it to justify the further killing of innocent Palestinian civilians in Gaza. I think it's time for us to say no to pinkwashing, say no to apartheid, say no to genocide or any attempt to pinkwash this genocide, because really you can't. There is no way you can pinkwash the genocide that is going against my people in Gaza right now.
I just want to pick up too that the thing about the lie of pinkwashing that I think I want everyone to understand so badly is that, like, governments that say that, you know, put out gay friendly messages to try to do this as propaganda are still at the exact same time still doing all the homophobic and transphobic stuff they do. And that's true here in the US. I think about, you know, Obama was the first kind of pinkwashing president we had, who in his second term came out as like pro gay marriage. And it was this really big deal. And he did that because he was like, still hadn't closed Guantanamo Bay. He was still engaged in brutal warfare around the world. He needed to cover over his actual politics, which were, you know, he was the deporter in chief. He deported more people than any other president. And so to deal with that, he covered that over. And then what's missing there is, of course, like, how many people, you know, queer and trans people are more likely to be targeted for deportation, are more likely to be living in, you know, U.S. outrageous, huge prisons, are more likely to be targeted by police. All of the exact same people that everything that the pinkwasher says they're protecting is, it's to see it more clearly, you know, pinkwashing is, never actually about the lives or well-being of queer and trans people. It's about using a rainbow flag to wrap around a cop or to wrap around a tank or a missile. And I think it's really, really important for us to keep an eye on that. And, you know, to some degree, some queer and trans people get wrapped up in it. Like, some queer and trans people and then end up being like the person hosting the, you know, Israeli delegation in their city in the US or whatever it is, because, you know, they're buying into the propaganda. They don't realize it's propaganda, which is, it's hard to read as propaganda for a lot of good reasons. People want to be included. They love the idea of a gay friendly country because they live with homophobia and transphobia. It's very compelling propaganda. So important for us to realize that it has nothing to do with our lives, and it doesn't make queer and trans people's lives better. It's killing queer and trans people in Gaza right now, right? And it's killing queer and trans people at the hands of police in the United States right now. And I think that's just like, I really appreciate what you said. It really pulls apart that distinction.
Going back to my question about kind of personal journeys, another thing I want to ask you both about, and thank you both for sharing about that, was the use of sexual violence and also the discourse around it. I mean, we see the New York Times had this report that's been discredited, but of course the damage is done in many ways. And we saw a lot of atrocity propaganda. That rape was used as a weapon, a mass weapon, on October 7th. We've seen that story was not journalism. It was basically fake news and atrocity propaganda. But I know just from speaking to people, I mean, I've heard countless people use that story to justify what America is doing, regardless of whether or not it's true. And at the same time, we've seen there were recent reports of sexual violence against Palestinian women and girls in Gaza. And we've seen photo after photo of Israeli soldiers with women's lingerie. So I wanted to know your thoughts on this display of sexual violence that's being ignored on the one hand, and then sexual violence that did not happen that's being talked about by the New York Times and other legacy media.
Yes, of course. We have heard many fabricated stories about sexual violence being committed on October 7th. We haven't seen any evidence. I mean, I totally believe women when they say they were raped, but, you know, we didn't hear any testimonies of any woman giving testimonies. On the other hand, we have seen UN reports of hostages that were taken from Gaza, female hostages that were kidnapped by Israeli soldiers who suffered sexual abuse. We have heard testimonies, and there was a UN report as well about a Palestinian female political prisoners in Israeli prison, which were facing also sexual violence and sexual abuse. We have heard many testimonies and read many testimonies from hostages, Palestinian hostages and political prisoners who were also facing sexual abuse and threats for rape. I have one thing to say about it. It's part of the fabrication and lies that Israel continues, Israel and its allies continue to use in order to create more chaos and more fear. And I think it's very important that we see it clearly and we're not distracted from our efforts, our collective efforts to end the ongoing genocide on Palestinians in Gaza right now.
Yeah, I'll just also add that, you know, for me, it's so tied in with pinkwashing, because one of the things, you know, a very typical racist and colonizer move is to say that the people you're trying to colonize, like, do sexuality wrong. And so to say that they're sexist and homophobic. And this is, you know, when Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, gave her famous speech about how gay rights are human rights, she was like saying, we're going to now justify the war on terror by saying that these countries are too homophobic and we need to bomb them. You know, like, that's the move. And that is there's such a long history of that. You know, colonizers who colonized Hawaii, who colonized the U.S., who colonized South Africa, the thing they say is these people, the way they treat their women is wrong, or they don't live in the kind of family group we think they should, or they're not modest. They don't wear European clothing. They don't do European gender norms. We need to save them, civilize them, and colonize them. That's the same thing that Gadir was saying earlier about how Palestinians are framed as being too homophobic. This here in the U.S., there's narratives about Black and Latino people being more homophobic that are completely made up, that are used to justify the idea that certain people are, like, backwards and that they're not, you know, like, cutting edge and not progressive, you know, all of that. So this is just like a long journey. And of course, that narrative is going to come through. And then, and that always also goes with the colonizer using sexual violence against the colonized. I mean, so to me, it feels like very classic. And it's very hard for all of us who are feminists, who are like, we are like, let's take sexual violence extremely seriously, especially as something that occurs, you know, in the context of militarism, very relentlessly, you know, all over the world, and especially U.S. militarism, I'll add, which Israeli militarism has a lot of, you know, similarities to. And so it's very difficult the way that these kind of disingenuous narratives about caring about sexual violence get played by the very people who are creating conditions that'll guarantee more sexual violence. And when I see all these images of Israeli soldiers holding Palestinians naked at gunpoint, that is sexual violence. When you strip search people, that is sexual violence. You know, it's so routine, it's throughout, right? Imprisoning people and inevitably stripping them, which is always part of that, is sexual violence. It's routine. And that's part of Israeli day-to-day action against Palestinians for all these years. You know, there's just so much that's not discussed about how sexual violence is inescapably part of the settler colonial project of the U.S. and of, you know, South Africa and of Israel and all the places that are doing that tactic.
Right. So it's almost mundane. I mean, it's so built into it that we don't sometimes even realize it.
Right. And also just, you know, in terms of sexual and reproductive justice, like what we really care about, how can you have sexual and reproductive justice when you're being pushed out of your home, when your parts of your family are being bombed to death, when you can't eat, when you don't have clothing? Like, our vision of what the freedom is that we believe in as feminists is these kind of like disingenuous use of allegations about sexual violence that are very cherry picked and don't look at the context really, really misses like the sort of robust idea about sexual freedom that could never include genocide, could never include having these militaries.
Yeah, I actually interviewed a Palestinian American Michigan college student who was part of some panel on Face the Nation. And she said that she's not going to vote for Biden, definitely not in the primary. I don't think she'll vote for him in the general either. But she was saying that reproductive freedom and reproductive justice is really important to her. And she couldn't vote for someone overseeing a genocide where women were giving birth on the streets without having C-sections, without anesthesia, not having any, you know, neonatal or prenatal care.
Yeah, but Biden is paying to bomb hospitals. If you care about women, about children, about babies, about, you know, and before October 7th, there's been this long history of the United States paying for Israel to have this separation or, you know, apartheid wall, as we call it, that ensures that people will not be able to get the healthcare they need around their reproductive health. I mean, every aspect of apartheid and genocide and colonialism is at odds with reproductive freedom.
Yeah. I wanted to know both of your thoughts on the self-immolation of Aaron Bushnell from both of your perspectives to hear what you had to say about that.
seen?
Yeah, I mean, I was immensely moved. I am immensely moved hearing Erin Bushnell's story and hearing interviews with Erin's friends and hearing Erin's own words. I mean, I've just been thinking about the clarity of this person's analysis of the situation and what it means to, you know, when I hear Ghadir and others speaking, I just think like, we should let what is happening into us as far as we can. People in the U.S. are encouraged to not really grasp what is going on and what the U.S. role in it is. And so to like really let it in and let it shape your life and let it determine what you do with your time and let it make you feel like this must stop no matter what. And I would give anything to make it stop. And thinking about all the people in history who have fought against colonialism and given their lives. And then thinking about Erin's act and then, you know, the history of other people who have self-immolated in opposition to U.S. wars and U.S., you know, funding of wars. It's very intense. It's very tragic. It's very moving. I feel like it also made me think about Chelsea Manning and the history of so many gay organizations in the U.S., you know, not standing behind Chelsea Manning, who had made these immense sacrifices in opposition to U.S. war and who spent so much time in prison and being tortured, you know, and how few people stood with her. And it was, you know, it was anti-war people and it was trans people who stood with her, but so many of like the larger gay organizations, like they wouldn't touch her with a 10-foot pole. And just thinking about people in our communities who have made these extreme risks and sacrifices to stand up for what is right. Especially, it's interesting when it's people who've been in the military and been right up at the front line of this horrible machine. I've just been felt very emotionally moved by Erin Bushnell's act, very heartbroken. It just opens up these deep questions of like, how can I further and more deeply dedicate myself when someone has taken me, given like ultimate risk, to stopping genocide that is happening with my tax dollars in my name as an American, also as a Jewish person. Like, I mean, this is a huge, it's a huge provocation and it's really heartbreaking also.
Yeah. I would just add to Dean's that I watched a video of, some of the Erin Bushnell's friends and colleagues in the Air Force, in the U.S. Army, standing and burning their army jackets and saying that Erin Bushnell was not alone. And for me, as a Palestinian, to see this, American soldiers are saying that he wasn't alone and that they will not sit silent and they will not cooperate with this was really very moving and very powerful. And it's really heartbreaking that somebody has to do this in order to get attention from his government. It's very sad.
And Dean, any final words from you? And thank you both for your time, because I know how busy you are.
I'm just really grateful to you for focusing on this in the show, Katie. I think pinkwashing is, you know, is one of the cutting edges of Israeli and U.S. propaganda that people need a lot of help figuring out how to fight in their local contexts. And it's so unbearably outrageous to see, like, you know, gay flags raised over, you know, Gazan land that has been cleared of people who've been slaughtered. It's like, this is not what queer liberation is about or has ever been about. It is such an incredible theft of queer liberation and of queer lives to use our symbols in this way and to have these, you know, hideous militaristic governments co-opt our symbols and our lives. And so I really appreciate you making space for this conversation. And I'm, you know, eternally grateful for the work of Palestinian queer and trans people who are, you know, leading the analysis and partnering people all around the world to try to stop pinkwashing at all of its fronts in all of our countries. So I really appreciate that.
Dean, I want to know if you were ever seduced by Israel. I mean, you mentioned you were a Jewish person. If you had an aha moment with Israel if you were more of a liberal, like let's say a two-state solution person, what was your journey on that?
Yeah, I think my journey is a little different. I grew up in the rural South. There weren't a lot of Jewish people around me. And I never, even though I was Jewish, I never was like, had that Israel seduction. I wasn't part of a Jewish community in which anyone was like, Israel's amazing, or you should go visit Israel or anything like that. So I didn't grow up with Zionist messaging, besides just the U.S. general, you know, the kind of New York Times style Zionist messaging that everybody in the U.S. gets. So I didn't have that kind of emotional attachment to Israel that I know a lot of Jews are raised with in the U.S. And so my first real learning about Palestine was actually being in lefty movements in New York City and having just Palestine solidarity be part of what was a normal part of the politics alongside solidarity with Puerto Rico. Honestly, those two things were usually side by side in the, it was like the timing where people were trying to fight against the bombing of Vieques by the U.S. military. And people would often talk about how the same kinds of military weapons were being used in Palestine and being used in Puerto Rico. And that was my introduction to it. And of course, I had to do a bunch of learning, like, what is Zionism? And what is Christian Zionism? And why do these Christians who hate Jews love Israel? I mean, I had to, like, you know, do a lot of my own political ed with my friends. And, you know, at the time, it was the 90s. I'm reading zines. And I of course, met tons and tons of queer people, Jews and Palestinians and other people who told me what was what. But I didn't have to work through what so many Jewish people have to work through of having been kind of like given a bunch of lies about Israel, extra lies inside, you know, the Jewish community.
Kadir, I want to make sure to give you a chance to explain what Aswat does, the work Aswat does.
Well, Aswat is not active anymore, but when Aswat was active, basically it was a hub for Palestinian queer women to meet and, you know, operating programs, according to the needs of the community. As I said earlier, you know, educational workshops to service providers, people working within schools, you know, psychologists, social workers, and so on. Having a queer film festival where, you know, we host, film producers, in Haifa hubs, and also, you know, I think one of the most visible programs that the most important contribution of Aswat over the years, probably two decades of work and activism, is the knowledge production program, which produces over 30 productions in Arabic about sexual identity, sexual and gender identity, which wasn't existent in Arabic. When I was questioning my sexuality, there was nothing in Arabic that I could read about it. So one of the things that we did with Aswat is to produce knowledge in Arabic about what it means to be queer, you know, within this region. And one of the productions actually includes 23 narratives of queer and trans women from the region, which means from the Middle East and North Africa, not just Palestine. And I think it also gives a chance to share this experience, because being based and under Israeli occupation, apartheid, and settler colonialism also doesn't only create this fragmentation for us, you know, people living 2.3 million people living in besieged Gaza, another 2 million living in the occupied Palestinian territories, 2 million living inside Israel. So there's a lot of fragmentation that did not allow us to meet and interact and communicate. And the same thing goes for all the Arab countries that are, you know, surrounding us. There's no interaction. Let's say Lebanon, which is like 2 hours drive from my house, is an enemy state. So there was no, we lacked opportunities to interact with, you know, with the Arab world or with Palestinians here. So it was important to produce knowledge that would be accessible to everyone who reads Arabic, whether in the region or around the world. And that's how, you know, we try to tell the narratives, the personal, social, and political narratives of queer and trans people through these productions. And of course, to raise awareness amongst the general public, and, you know, with regards to sexual and gender rights and freedoms.
One more thing I would love to include, if it's okay.
Yeah, of course.
So as you mentioned in my bio, several years back, we made a movie here in Seattle about a story of a pinkwashing tour coming to Seattle and the ways people did activism to push back on it against the city, which was hosting it. And that movie is kind of a really great, like, it's designed like a pinkwashing 101. And it's, you know, in a story about queer activists in the U.S. And it's free online. People can screen it. at their university or in their friend circle or at their local movie house. And it's got captions in like 5 or 6 languages that people have made all over the world who screened it and wanted it to be accessible, most recently Albanian, but also more common languages like Spanish. And so I just wanted to tell people it's a free resource that's out there, and it's at pinkwashingexposed.net. And hopefully people can use that to help build the conversation inside their own local communities.
Katie, I just wanted to add that maybe one of the most important contribution of Aswat and the queer movement in Palestine is uniting, our struggles, uniting feminism with queerism, with the fight against all forms of oppression into a monumental struggle that became effective locally and globally. And that's how we can today not just communicate with global queer, but have very, very strong ties. And global queer has played a very, very important role in promoting a better understanding of the situation here in Palestine.
Well, Ghadir, I know you have to leave us shortly. Any final words? And I'm so grateful for you taking the time.
Thank you very much. I would like to also, in this very, very dark days, to send a message of hope, because without hope, we have nothing. So we still have hope, because I see how grassroots mobilizing very, very creatively and consistently. I see nations around the world, people around the world going out in organized marches. I see them getting not just angry and frustrated, but getting really, really committed, renewing their commitment to justice, renewing their commitment to people in Palestine and to justice and freedom in Palestine, and doing everything in their power to contribute to liberation in Palestine. And I think this is very admirable and very much needed. But we need to do much more. And I think that every day that the war goes by, it's not just more people are dying, more people are losing hope. So we have to bring hope back to the people of Gaza. We have to save lives today. And when we talk about queer lives and we say queer lives matter and queer bodies matter, everybody matters. But if you're a queer person and you want to contribute to queer liberation globally, you have to care about queer people in Gaza, and you have to do everything you can in order to support liberation in Palestine.
Thank you so much.
I think it's really important that you mentioned colonial, feminism and pinkwashing to justify genocide. This is very important. And I think a lot of, feminists and queer will not stand side when they see that this is also happening in their name.
Yeah, it's just seeing these people like who consider themselves liberal allies with like talking about how Hamas wants to throw all gay people off the roofs and they're all rapists. And it's, and again, I'm just like, do you honestly think you're being a good ally by advocating bombing people? Like, what do you think happens to the queer people who you claim to care about or who you say are part of your community? Like, are they immune to bombs? Like what? I just don't understand it. It's just, propaganda brain.
Yeah, this is where pinkwashing, this is where colonial feminism and pinkwashing play a very important role. But I think we should also, be aware that there's a lot of queer action happening around the world. There are more than 4,000 queer artists signed a pledge for Palestine and for an immediate ceasefire and a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. We have seen more than 27,000 queer organizations in the U.S. are also calling for a ceasefire. Dean, you mentioned ACT UP. ACT UP in New York endorsed BDS and also issued a statement for a ceasefire right now. Even the most mainstream LGBT organization in the U.S., the Task Force, are also organizing around recognizing the roots of this conflict are based in white supremacy and colonialism and asking for an immediate ceasefire. So we see a lot of people are gathering around the world, working individually and collectively in order to have a very clear voice against Israel's atrocities, against Israel's ongoing oppression of Palestinians, of all Palestinians, queer and non-queer alike. And I really believe, I have hope that the actions, the massive actions of these people will really shake the ground from under the people who are sending bombs and supporting Israel with everything that it's doing throughout this genocide. So I hope that, you know, throughout history, the people, the nations, they have the chance to bring more justice to themselves and other nations. And we've seen it work in many places around the world. So I am hopeful that these efforts will be fruitful. Today, everybody knows about Palestine. Everybody knows about Gaza. Israel, what we couldn't do in 75 years, Israel was able to do in 147 days. So there's no excuse. I remember, you know, earlier days, we used to come to the U.S. and, you know, tell people about what's happening in Palestine. But today, everybody knows. You see it on your screens. You see it in the news. You see it everywhere. People talk about it all the time. So everybody knows. So it's not ignorance. It's the truth is out there. It's very clear. And you have a very important choice to make. Do you let this genocide continue to happen, or do you do everything in your power to stop it and take immediate action? So I think it's a very simple equation, whether we choose to be human or not. And I think many people around the world are choosing to be human and are choosing to be not just in solidarity. It's not about solidarity and support anymore. It's about saving lives. Every minute you save lives.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.